Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus with Radio America. Jim is also, of course, the author of the forthcoming The Weed Agency, due out June 3rd. You can pre-order it now at Amazon and other sites, and get your hard copy as soon as it comes out in early June. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual. And, Jim, we start with the good, which is not that good if your name is Jill Abramson. She, until yesterday, was the editor of the New York Times, but she was abruptly fired and replaced yesterday. And everybody, of course, in the media world was biting their fingernails, wondering why. Most of the rest of the world, of course, didn't care. But the Weekly Standard has an interesting take on this, which dovetails very interestingly with some of the Democratic policy narratives right now. This is what it says. As with any such upheaval, there's a history behind it. Several weeks ago, Abramson discovered that her pay and her pension benefits as both executive editor and before that as managing editor were considerably less than the pay and pension benefits of Bill Keller, the male editor whom she replaced in both jobs. She confronted the top brass, one close associate said, and this may have fed into the management's narrative that she was quote-unquote pushy, a characterization that for many has an inescapably gendered aspect. Sulzberger is known, he's the publisher of the Times, to believe that the Times, as a financially beleaguered newspaper, needed to retreat on some of its generous pay and pension benefits. So, Jim, how interesting that the pay gap for women, income inequality or equality, is coming to a head at a place like the New York Times, which, of course, is the champion of the liberal agenda.
I think we found the war on women, Greg, and it's being perpetuated by a newspaper nicknamed the Old Gray Lady. A couple things that kind of come out. Obviously, like everybody in right world was chuckling pretty loudly at the hot water that the Times found itself in. We've seen the phrase lately, check your privilege.
Yes.
You, Corumbus, coming from fine WASP ancestry, should be, checking your privilege. But anyway, if you want to know, you really should check your privilege. When people call you pinch, that's when. Salary negotiation is always kind of one of these areas, a little bit of mystery. It's usually not done very much out in the open, other than maybe for professional athletes. You don't really have a good sense of what the market is. If you're paying somebody less because they're a woman, that's wrong. That's bad. I think everybody in America would say, you know what, you shouldn't pay somebody less just because of what gender they are. Having said that, every employer is going to want to get the best deal they can, meaning get the best talent for the least amount of pay. And every employee is going to want to get the most money that they possibly can get. And so Jill Abramson is perfectly within her rights to say, hey, you know, am I getting what I ought to get for this job? Having said that, you know, maybe that was how much the New York Times could pay. The New York Times managers and Pinch probably would say, look, there was no sexism in this. This is just us trying to keep an eye on the bottom line and calculating what we could afford to pay. That's perfectly fine, except that's what every other business would like to say. In other words, that, you know, is every instance in which a woman is getting paid less than a man an instance of horrible sexism on the part of the employer, or are there other factors at work? I mean, the New York Times would say, no, it's other factors at work, except they never gave that benefit of the doubt to anybody else. And they were very quick to insist, you know, the one exception to this, of course, Greg, was the White House. They never really gave the White House that much grief for paying its women employees less than its male employees. This was a story that sent huge, huge, you know, reverberations through the Acela corridor media world, and most of the rest of the country didn't notice at all. I think when you have is when the executive editor of the New York Times leaves very suddenly, lots of people in this Acela corridor media world really don't know who they should suck up to, particularly if they're freelancers or they want to write for the New York Times someday or they want to get on the op-ed page. So you can kind of sympathize with that. It sounds like this is a fairly run-of-the-mill management dispute, but it's got, because of the, you know, Democrats having beat the drums on the war on women so much lately, it appears that the, you know, the journalistic institution has been progressives' best friend for ages and ages, is now hoist on its own petard and now looks like they're as bad as anybody as it comes to not treating women correctly and not paying them what they deserve and being rather sexist in their attitudes.
Arthur Sulzberger Jr. is Pinch, in case anybody didn't know that.
He's Pinch. Everyone calls him Pinch.
All right.
It's a tough decision to make. It's a Pinch 22.
On to the bad martini now. And, of course, the Benghazi defense of Hillary Clinton has been ongoing for a long time now because, of course, she's the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee for 2016. But then again, she was 6 years ago, too. But Bill Clinton was speaking at the Peter G. Peterson Foundation this week. They're usually big on fiscal responsibility, but Gwen Ifill was the moderator for this conversation, and she was asking Bill Clinton about Hillary's handling of Benghazi, and Bill says, oh, she did just fine. She did exactly what I would have done. Here's his rationale for that.
In my opinion, Hillary did what she should have done. She impaneled a very high-level review committee with the immediate past chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, who's backstage, and Tom Pickering, our country's most distinguished senior diplomat, who's worked for more Republicans than Democrats in his life. And they looked into what was wrong. They gave 29 recommendations. She took them and started implementing them.
Not only that, he says that his actions as president and Hillary's actions as Secretary of State trumped the actions of the Bush administration during some of the diplomatic problems that we had during those 8 years.
Most Americans don't even know how many American diplomatic personnel were killed when President Bush was president. They don't know what, if any, after action review was done, what, if any, recommendations were made, what, if any, action was taken to implement those. So I think my advice to everybody involved is to be not defensive and realize what this is and answer the questions.
What is it?
Nah, you just want me to get in a political fight. I'm not running for anything. I'm not doing that.
So there you go, Jim. Hillary Clinton did exactly what she should after these people died, just like Clinton says he did after the East Africa embassy bombings. And, of course, he was clearly implying that this was nothing more than a political investigation when it comes to Benghazi. So not exactly sure that thwarting terrorism is his specialty, given his track record.
There's not a lot else he could say without getting in real, real trouble. You know, like, well, Hillary screwed up, and let me tell you why. Let me tell you what I would have done instead. You know, that inevitably, if he's not sleeping on the couch already, that would leave him there in those circumstances. So obviously he's got to defend his wife. His answer to that question really focuses a lot on what she could have or should have done afterwards. As much as the Internal Accountability Board, I suppose, it made a lot of the recommendations. I think a lot of us have pointed out the big issue is that the four people who are most responsible for the decisions leading up to the Benghazi attack were put on paid administrative leave, otherwise known as a paid vacation. They were reinstated. They were put into new jobs. And so they're really, nobody lost their job over this. Nobody was fired. Nobody really suffered that much of a serious consequence for making these decisions that cost people their lives. The two big questions, I think, for a lot of people, one is that, look, Benghazi in Libya was a big central project of the Obama administration's first-term foreign policy. This was going to be one of their great success stories. And I think it's safe to say it has not turned out as a success story. So I think one of the first questions is, did they accurately assess the prospects for a stable government after Gaddafi's fall? Clinton doesn't want us to look at any of that stuff. Then the next big question is, on that night, there are a couple points in the House Armed Services Committee report of this that basically said, look, the military was waiting for a request from the State Department. You're kind of left with that question of, like, really? Wait, why isn't everybody going to battle stations? Why wasn't everybody mobilizing? What was going on that night? And then the question of afterwards, who was held accountable? And, she left, she even was scheduled to leave, but, Hillary Clinton did not stick along all that afterwards. She only made one appearance before Congress. It was the infamous, at this point, what difference does it make statement? There's a lot to ask there. And, unsurprisingly, Bill Clinton, is saying, oh, there's nothing there. There's nothing else we could have done. Nobody could have handled any better. Everything's fine. Not directly spoken, but clearly insinuated in his statements that there's no serious issue there. And I think that's pretty laughable. But again, I guess it's what we should be expecting from the Clintons as they approach a presidential campaign.
Yeah, obviously, they're going to downplay that as much as humanly possible. So, all right, on to the crazy martini now. And this comes to us from NBC Sports, but it's been announced in a bunch of different places. Rams defensive end Michael Sam is getting a reality show. The Oprah Winfrey Network announced today that it is working with Sam on a reality TV project that will show his life as the first openly gay player in the NFL. His quote, like every other player out there working to make a team right now, my focus is on playing football to the very best of my ability. Oh, and if seeing my story helps someone else accept who they are and go for their dreams, that's great. So, Jim, I'm not sure this is just about making a football team, but he does join in a long, illustrious list of seventh-round draft picks with their own reality shows before they get to training camp. Like, help me out here.
I'm one of those guys who, if Michael Sam has what it takes to play in the NFL, God bless him. Good luck to him. He seems like he's got at least up until recently, it seemed like he had a really good head on his shoulders and he was, had what it takes. But talent-wise, This was a guy who was always kind of in that gray area. He's relatively undersized for his position. You look at what he did in college, he generally did his most dramatic games against talent that's considerably less what you're going to expect in the NFL. Then he went to the Indianapolis Combine, which is where they take all the players and they do all kinds of physical athletic tests, and he didn't do as nearly as well there as everybody hoped. So yes, he was the defensive player of the year for his conference, but a lot of people were looking at him and saying, this is not a guy who is guaranteed to make the NFL and certainly not guaranteed to be a star in the NFL. He really is kind of a bubble guy, could be playing on special teams, could be on the practice squad for a while. Sam gets picked by the St. Louis Rams. It's close to home. Good luck. You know, Rams seemed very happy with this. I'm sure the NFL was happy that he was selected so that nobody could say, oh, this is, you know, homophobia at work. But now the reality show. I think a lot of people had said, fairly or not, hey, is this going to be a distraction for the team that selects him? And fans of Sam said, no, and you can't hold us against this. And you know, a couple of people wondered whether this was a flip side of the coin when Tim Tebow was selected for being a very clear, proud, you know, some would say outspoken Christian and, you know, living his values. Look, Michael Sam deserves the chance to succeed the NFL, but on the flip side is that he would say that he's not expecting any special treatment because of who he is. Up until now, I think that's the case. But once you start getting a reality show, and it's on Oprah, and it's going to get a great deal of hype and attention, and then a lot of people have kind of said, you know, boy, does that put the St. Louis Rams in a really difficult situation? That, you know, apparently he's already got the second highest selling jersey out of any NFL rookie. And there's a great deal of attention and people who wanted to see a homosexual player succeed in the NFL are on his bandwagon. They want to see him succeed. Well, he may not. And the question is, what happens if he doesn't? Is there this sense of, that homosexuals can't play in the NFL? Or is the sense that, well, the hype got around him, it created a distraction? Or was it just that this guy, you know, was always a mid-range NFL player at best, and the hype around him tried to turn him into something he wasn't? Because there is this desire for a heroic narrative around these figures, the media is kind of stepping in and rushing in to create this narrative regardless of the facts. And I think that ends up hurting these athletes, and I think it may end up becoming a problem for Sam. I don't want to be seen as a Michael Sam basher, but this struck me as the first significant mistake he's made in his road to the NFL. It just really kind of seems like this could end up being a big distraction for the team and impede his NFL career instead of helping it.
One of the tweets earlier this week was, quick, name the two Rams picks from the first round.
Accurate. I follow football, and I don't think, because they had the defensive line guy and somebody on offense. That's my...
Yeah, they had an offensive lineman and a defensive lineman. I couldn't tell you their names right now, though, but interesting point. Jim, we'll do it again tomorrow. Have a great day.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Join us again on Friday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.